Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
If there is a theme to today's program, other than the increasingly dangerous geopolitical situation with Russia, that theme is spring fever. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Oakland, I'm Molly Wood in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, April 19th. Good to have you with us. Let's check in on the state of reopening. As of today, everyone 16 and older is now eligible to receive a COVID vaccine in every single state. More than 200 million shots have already been given in the U.S. so far. About half of all adults have received at least one dose. The vaccine is free, whether you have health insurance or not. But even minus the massive logistics of distributing the vaccine, there are logistics involved in getting it. And some workers are having trouble getting paid time off to get their shots or to deal with side effects. From the Workplace Culture Desk, Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has the story.
When Washington, D.C. software engineer Lori Barth got the vaccine last month, it kind of kicked her butt. Headache, chills, brain fog.
I don't think I could have read text on a screen comfortably, let alone like sit up in a chair.
Barth didn't have to worry about working through the pain because she got her vaccine on a weekend, and she has plenty of paid sick time she could have used. But not all workers do, says Vicky Shabo, a senior fellow with New America.
You could very easily see how it would be financially impossible and potentially job risking for a worker to be able to get a vaccine.
There is no national requirement that employers offer any sick leave, much less a couple days to get vaccinated. And low-wage essential workers are among the least likely to have paid time off, says Elise Gould with the Economic Policy Institute.
They may not have a lot of power to negotiate for when the best time is to have the vaccine so that they make sure they don't have to work the next day in case there's side effects that impact them.
13 states and several dozen cities do mandate some form of paid sick leave, and many employers like McDonald's, Starbucks, and Walmart have offered paid time off for employees to get vaccinated. Dorit Rice, a law professor at UC Hastings, says it's important that workers have vaccine time off on top of their usual sick leave.
We don't want to make them choose between using limited, valuable paid sick leave for other needs and using it for the vaccine.
And some frontline workers might have already used up their sick leave because they got COVID. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
So clearly it'll help business to get more people vaccinated. The weather's warming up, consumer spending is increasing. Business owners may be feeling optimistic about what's ahead. In fact, if you're a business owner who's made it this far, maybe you're thinking you're out of the woods. Let's check in on how people are feeling and what's still keeping them up at night. Sit-down restaurants were among the hardest hit industries by the pandemic. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab called some restaurant owners for a mood check.
Ring the bells, toss the confetti, pop the good champagne.
I'm ready to party. I'm ready to go.
Rami Rosello is calling it. Her Mexican restaurant, Comida, in Aurora, Colorado, has survived. Between steady takeout orders and more people returning to indoor dining, she's starting to see pre-pandemic sales figures. But it doesn't mean business is easy. Like today, Aurora is supposed to get up to 4 inches of snow, so no patio seating. And two staff members are out. One is isolating after a COVID exposure at home. The other has appendicitis.
It's just, you know, it's taxing on everybody. And I've wanted for people to not have to work any overtime so that we can ourselves stay healthy.
David Audrich, who edits the Small Business Economics Journal at Indiana University, says for businesses that entered the pandemic with a cash cushion, got PPP loans, or pivoted well.
Compared to a year ago, yes, many of them, they're out of the woods, that's for sure.
And they're having to deal with a good problem for a change. How to take advantage of the increasing demand they've been dreaming about.
Actually, now, the race is just starting.
Shaz Khan in the Twin Cities is trying to win that race through expansion. He co-owns Tono Pizzeria and Cheesesteaks, takeout-friendly food.
From a business standpoint, now is certainly the time.
He got a good deal on a new space and is opening a third restaurant, but he needs to hire 30 new employees and can't find enough qualified workers.
It certainly slowed things down, and I mean, we might be delaying our opening.
A new pizza shop and no one to make the pizzas. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, I don't want to buzzkill the optimism vibe, but even though the pandemic is improving here, that's not the case in the rest of the world. Lockdowns in India, ongoing surges in Brazil, and rising infections in Japan. Markets and multinationals are paying attention. Details and more when we do the numbers. Back to the confidence theme. Last week, Microsoft announced it will buy Nuance, a company that makes speech recognition tech for healthcare organizations. The deal is valued at $19 billion all in, making it Microsoft's second largest acquisition ever after LinkedIn. It ups Microsoft's presence in healthcare, but is also a bet on boom times for speech recognition. Daniel Hong is a researcher at Forrester. We called him to get a sense of that business right now. Daniel, thanks for coming on the show.
Sure.
We're talking about Microsoft's acquisition of Nuance, which of course is primarily about healthcare use. But I wonder, what does the acquisition say about the current state of speech recognition overall?
I think speech has really changed in the last 10 years. And a lot of that is because of deep neural nets and using that approach to really improve the accuracy of speech recognition and understanding what people are actually saying. If a consumer is talking to their Google Home device, they can really ask it anything and try to get an answer. Mm-hmm. But in medicine, it's pretty finite the way people mm-hmm. will express themselves about pain, about discomfort. So if you have something that's a bit more finite, the accuracy rates actually are higher.
It sounds like you're describing kind of two paths for interaction with voice recognition technologies. And one is sort of this high accuracy, maybe low flexibility interaction, right? Where you're using a lot of medical terms. And then the other is this sort of free floating, I'm going to say whatever I want to Google. And I assume that that one is a lot harder, right? Which is why it sometimes feels like Google doesn't understand a thing I'm saying.
Yes. and there's a bit more complexity. The Googles and the Amazons and the Apples, they're actually pretty good with general questions. Mm-hmm. But now we're seeing a little bit more complexity in terms of the questions that you can ask. So you can ask, how old was Joe Biden's wife when he became president? Mm-hmm. Another area is the context. Having that conversation with the Google Homes and the Amazon Alexas. How's the weather in Florence? What about Paris? What about the temperature in these areas in Celsius? And that's an area where we've seen quite a bit of improvement over the last few years, but there's still a long ways to go.
What do you think are the biggest growth areas you see for speech recognition? I mean, I'm surprised at how many people I know who still don't just dictate every single thing to their phone like I do.
Yeah, I think we're just going to see the application of speech being used more on a day-to-day basis to conduct tasks. So I think in the home, you're able to operate lights, talking to your car, changing the temperature control, so on and so forth, will be more and more inclined to use voice as the technology improves. And actually, there are a lot more microphones in the house. I think we're really on the cusp of voice being able to have a lot more innovative use cases. It's just we need to get the accuracy there, and we have to essentially get more devices out there to consumers.
What about, certainly the reaction that is inevitable when you say more microphones is a question of privacy, especially if we start using this in doctors' offices. Is there, do you think, a corresponding effort to do on device processing or make sure that recordings aren't kept, or is that still pretty mm-hmm. much Wild West?
I think it's a bit of both. There's a lot of compliance in healthcare. So a lot of these systems in hospitals and even those being used by healthcare insurers have to meet these very strict guidelines to be able to have a technology rolled out. That said, it'll have to evolve over time. You should probably let the patient know this is being recorded and like they have to have the opt-in capability. All these things will be ironed out as speech becomes more mainstream in healthcare and in other areas of, you know, the consumer's world.
Daniel Hong is a research director at Forrester. Thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
We've got a longer version of this interview where we talked about how companies with lots of data and experience are leading in speech recognition. Think Google. That's over on my other show, Marketplace Tech. Later this week, we're going to get an update on existing and new home sales numbers. Demand has been B-A-N-A-N-A-S. You may remember that last week, new home starts reached a 15-year high, and that's happening despite the fact that the price of a key ingredient in homes is going through the roof, no pun intended. Lumber now costs four times what it did a year ago, four times. It's at a record high, $1,326.70 per thousand board feet. We asked Marketplace's Sabri Benishore to find out why.
It is true. A lot of people stuck at home decided to fix their homes up.
We've been swamped in the last two, three, 4 weeks.
Nancy Kiefer runs Moyer's Sawmill a couple hours outside of Philadelphia. It's just four people. They normally cut wood for barns and sheds. Now, contractors are coming asking for wood to use in homes.
We had some kind of a contractor. He wanted like 3,000 2x4s. And I said, there's just no way we can do that.
The whole lumber supply chain wasn't quite ready for the demand. Stinson Dean is CEO of Deacon Lumber, a wholesaler.
We're very scarred from what we went through in the Great Recession.
It took a long time for people all through the lumber supply chain, he says, to believe that demand was actually going to come back, let alone come back with a vengeance.
So inventory stayed lean. Production schedules stayed lean. It's just you buy exactly what you need for that day, that week, and you do not buy extra.
But even without a pandemic, lumber prices were headed up. John Duncanson is the timber analyst at Corton Capital.
All COVID did was throw up a bit of a smoke screen.
He says the average age of U.S. homes is now approaching 45 years old. So demand for wood for repairs and remodels has been building for way longer than the pandemic. And natural disasters have cut supply.
Canada, in particular, Western Canada and British Columbia, have had the forests that there have been faced with infestations of mountain pine beetle, as they call it, basically killed every third tree.
All this put together, says Duncanson, means he doesn't think lumber prices are going to go back to normal. Not anytime soon. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Coming up.
The truth is, America has its own interest in this deal.
Welcome to politics. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dipped 123 points, 0.3% to close at 34,077. The NASDAQ sank 137 points, nearly a full percent, to finish at 13,914. The S&P 500 retreated 22 points, 0.5%, to end at 4163. A roller coaster for South by Southwest over the last year or so. The publisher of Billboard, Variety, and Rolling Stone is investing in South by Southwest. The festival has not held its in-person music, film, and tech events since 2019, of course, because of the pandemic. Penske Media Corporation will take a 50% stake, but the festival will still be operated by the founders. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.60%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. A little more on housing and how home ownership in the U.S. starkly reflects the racial economic divide. At the end of 2020, the home ownership rate among white Americans stood at about 74.5%, while just 44% of black Americans owned homes. Now let's look at another measure of that divide when it comes to creating affordable housing in general. Across the country, developers get tax credits for building affordable housing units. But even those subsidized developments may not be evenly distributed. An analysis of an affordable housing program in Chicago finds that it's helped perpetuate segregation over the last 20 years. WBEZ's Natalie Moore in Chicago reports.
The West Loop is a bustling neighborhood with high-rises and high-end restaurants. So this isn't the kind of neighborhood where you'll find a lot of affordable apartments. One of the ways developers get incentives to build affordable units is through a federal program called Low-Income Housing Tax Credits, known as LIHTC. It's the largest source of federal money to go toward affordable rental housing. Over the past 20 years, developers in Chicago have built or preserved 10,000 affordable units in the city. But a recent study found racial inequities where they were built.
We have to be honest, the government has been complicit with the private sector for decades in segregating our communities and devaluing black and brown spaces.
That's Housing Commissioner Marisa Navarra. Here's what the city racial equity impact assessment found. The majority of the housing tax credits went to high poverty areas. Fewer than 20% of units are in majority white neighborhoods. 50% of all low-income units are in majority black neighborhoods. That's a disproportionate share because just 35% of Chicago census tracts are majority black. And that means that affordable apartments aren't going in areas like the West Loop that are rich with amenities and resources.
It was important for us to say we need to be accountable for our outcomes. We need to examine the results of our work by race and based on what we learn, adjust accordingly.
Today, the city considers affordable rent to be about $1,500 a month for a family of four. Enterprise Community Partners is a national affordable housing nonprofit that worked with the city on the racial assessment. Andy Gere says Chicago is the first to do this kind of racial equity study in the country. And he adds it should be replicated.
It's an opportunity for any housing finance agency really to start to think about how they can advance through affordable housing production racial equity goals.
There are examples of how the city of Chicago has been able to use this type of racial equity assessment to prevent further harm to black communities. A few years ago, Chicago looked at closing a public elementary school that served predominantly black students. Ultimately, Chicago Public Schools nixed the school closure after the group Chicago United for Equity, or CUE, did an assessment and found students were thriving at the school because it was designed to support them. Nikita Brar is the founder of CUE. She says policymakers are trained to look for unintended consequences.
But there isn't necessarily always a way to address that proactively. And racial equity impact assessments help us find ways to anticipate those unintended consequences.
Now that the Chicago Housing Department knows the unintended consequences of past housing policies, it is proposing a new set of priorities for the tax credit program. Those include making sure smaller housing developers of color can participate and that affordable rentals are built in areas with amenities like public transportation and stores that sell fresh food. In Chicago, I'm Natalie Moore for Marketplace.
The U.S. is pushing back hard on Russia's aggressive foreign policy, which has gotten even more aggressive in recent weeks. The EU estimated today that Russia has now placed 150,000 troops near Ukraine's borders. Last week, the Biden administration imposed heavy sanctions on Russian officials and diplomats over cybersecurity and other concerns, and it's threatening further sanctions, including on a major underwater gas pipeline called the Nord Stream 2. The 1,500-mile-long pipeline is designed to carry natural gas directly from Russia to the North German coast. It's almost complete at a cost of more than $11 billion. The German government supports the project, but the U.S. says it strengthens Russia economically and undermines the stability of Eastern Europe. So how is the threat of U.S. sanctions going down in Germany? From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
German supporters of the pipeline describe it as a bridge binding Russia to the West. Speaking in the Bundestag, Foreign Minister Heiko Maas said stopping the pipeline would drive Russia into economic isolation and into an alliance with China. He said, "I'm against tearing down this bridge with Russia." But opponents of the pipeline say it's not a bridge, it's a tentacle snaking out from the Kremlin. And, says German member of the European Parliament, Reinhard Bütikofer, it would entangle Germany with an odious regime.
How would we constrain them by handing Putin reliable revenue? I don't get the point. We would be fostering the aggressive policies of the Russian Tsar.
But supporters of the pipeline say there's an overwhelming economic and environmental case for Nord Stream 2.
In Europe, the need for secure, sustainable and affordable energy is growing.
As the project's promotional video points out, natural gas is cheap and emits much less carbon than oil or coal. Oh, and European gas production is declining.
The region will need to import more gas to meet its needs.
In transitioning to a carbon-free future, Germany has a particular difficulty, having decided to close down the last of its nuclear power stations by next year. Economist Gustav Horn.
Since we at the same time leave the atomic power strategy, we need some kind of bridging energy supply, and that is gas. And therefore we need this gas from Russia.
Horn, a senior figure in the SPD party, which is part of the governing coalition, deplores the threat of further US sanctions over the pipeline.
Certainly this is not appropriate given our otherwise very close relations.
And he suspects the US isn't driven solely by geopolitical concerns.
The truth is, America has its own interest in this deal, and I think America wants to supply more gas to Europe and especially to Germany, because Germany is a big market for that.
The American sanctions seem unlikely to prevent Nord Stream 2 from being physically completed. Almost 1,500 miles of the pipeline, hundreds of tons of steel have already been laid. There's only 90 miles or so to go. But the sanctions could prevent it from being certified and insured. Western companies could well be deterred from using it. And that would please Sascha Müller-Kreiner, head of the Environmental Action Group.
This pipeline, if run at full capacity, would bring an additional 100 million tons CO2 per year to Germany and to the European markets.
And he fears it would enable Russia to shut down the main existing gas pipeline across Ukraine, depriving that country of billions of dollars a year in transit fees and making it even more vulnerable to Russian aggression.
I think we should not strengthen Russia's hand by giving them another access point to the European market. That could sideline Ukraine, which is an important partner of Germany.
And yet he can't bring himself to voice support for American sanctions, which are widely regarded in Germany as foreign interference. But the Germans may well resolve the issue themselves. The Green Party has vowed that if it helps form the next coalition government after the election in the fall, it'll block Nord Stream 2. And the Greens are riding very high in the polls. At the European desk in London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out, lots of you might not even have heard of Clubhouse, the so-called social audio app where people hop on and give talks or hold panels or brainstorm or yell at each other. But it announced a $4 billion valuation today, and everyone's trying to kill it. Just today, in fact, Reddit and Facebook both announced audio products that look a lot like Clubhouse, betting that Even though vaccines are rolling out incredibly fast, the weather is warmer and we're ready to shop and go out to eat, we're still going to want to sit around the house listening to people talk on our phones. Okay. All right, we got to go. But first, your moment of economic context on this Monday, pandemic almost over indicator. New research from Deloitte shows people are dropping their streaming service subscriptions at a record rate. Translation? Like I said, we've watched everything there is to watch, and we are ready to go outside and play. Our daily production team includes Andy Corbin, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Minju Park. I'm Molly Wood. We'll be back tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.